Good morning. It is just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr, coming up next on the media and 7 o'clock weekend edition news from National Public Radio. Partly sunny today, highs in the low 30s, winds from the north 5 to 15. Our lows tonight in the mid to upper teens, and for tomorrow, partly sunny once again with highs in the low 30s. Blustery northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Monday, partly sunny with highs in the mid 30s. Coming up at 10 o'clock this morning, Dan Lentz, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. At noon, it's the recorded history of jazz with Paul Kivy. Right now, it's time for On the Media on KAXE.
On this week's On the Media, as funding for research hangs by a thread, some academics are worried about what has already been lost.
The time has come to reclaim our once great educational institutions from the radical left, and we will do that.
The Trump administration has now frozen more than $2 billion in federal research funding.
This would impact medical, engineering, and science research at the school.
That is looking for cures for some of our most devastating diseases.
I've lost grants that have totaled $6 or $7 million.
One of the things that he told us several times was that there are no bad words. Those of us who were spending a lot of time most days evaluating grants for their use of bad words know that that's not the case.
Now we're behind. And
already?
Yeah. Like every serious person understands, and we are now behind China.
It's season two of the Harvard Plan, our deep dive into the assault on universities. It's all coming up after this.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. We're introducing a new series, North Star Students. We want to highlight Northern Minnesota students who deserve to be recognized, whether that's for their athletic accomplishments, artistic endeavors, academic achievements, or other efforts. Here's what you can expect. With each North Star student, we'll have an interview with them on the KAXE Morning Show. There will also be a feature story and photos on our website, kaxe.org. Our first ever North Star student is Bemidji senior Abby Damon. She was nominated by her swim coaches, Lisa Freet and Danielle Bartz. They say Damon is really stepping up as a leader this year, volunteers many hours, and is a strong, silent example of what hard work can look like. Here's an excerpt of our interview with Damon and Bartz, starting with why she was nominated.
Just wonderful human being. She's a hard worker. She's positive. She's encouraging, good athlete or good student athlete. And so I think she's kind of got a good holistic picture of, or like working towards, you know, the academic and the athlete part, and being a good role model for everybody. She's inspiring to me every day. So I thought she'd be a perfect candidate.
Do you have any favorite Abby memories?
Oh, man. I don't know if I can think of anything on the spot. She's just a joy to work with every day. She's always working hard, which is awesome to see. And just smiley. And yeah, I'm trying to think of like a fun story, but
Fargo.
West.
Every single.
So we have a West Fargo invite every year. And I think even this year, she was sick. Every year she's been sick. The first year I was with the team, we ended up having to pull over because she was barfing on the bus. but she's still like, she was a trooper about it. And yeah, so this year she got to compete again, which was exciting. But yeah, still got sick. She's consistent. We like to talk about that quite a bit, I guess.
Abby, I wanted to ask you, what achievement in swimming are you most proud of?
I think I'm really proud that I've always kind of kept like a positive mindset about things. Like sometimes after a bad race, I'm like, oh my gosh, like that was just awful. But I've never like tore myself down to a point where I'm just like, I'm absolutely not doing this anymore. And also achievement, I just hope I have made a lasting impact on the younger girls on the team and that they can look up to me. And hopefully in the future, they want to be like have some of my traits too. So
what about outside of swimming? As your, you know, senior year, you're looking back quite a bit. What are some of your kind of accomplishments, whether in school or in other activities that you're proud of and thinking about a lot these days?
I'm really proud of like my work ethic, especially in school. Like I go home and I have a routine every night and I do homework for like 2.5 hours and it sucks. But also like you feel good when you have the grades you do. So school has been a big accomplishment for me.
And Danielle, is there anything, I don't think Abby's the bragging type. So is there anything she didn't say that she should have?
No, I think she's got it. Yeah, I'm glad that you're proud of how you're working hard in school and in the water and seeing that, putting all that hard work and the time, and like it really can suck sometimes a lot, like it's worth it. And she's able to see that and know that it's going to be paying off in the end.
That was our first North Star student, Bemidji senior Abby Damon, and her swim coach, Danielle Bartz. Visit kaxe.org for photos and more on Damon, including the full interview. There, you can also nominate someone you know for North Star student. We want to highlight students that might not always be in the spotlight, but deserve to be recognized. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at kaxe.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Michael Loewinger.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the Trump administration's pressure campaign on universities, one of the most potent weapons has turned out to be something a lot of people never thought of as a weapon at all. Grants to study deadly illnesses like colon cancer.
Here's our cell culture room.
Oh, wow.
Where we do genetic screens.
You have the white lab coats on hangers.
Yes, exactly.
Harvard Medical School's Kamila Naxarova. We heard from her last week in the first episode of The Harvard Plan, Season 2, our mini-series produced with the Boston Globe about the struggle for control of higher education. For Naxarova, the cuts to grants are threatening her ability to keep her lab open.
And it was unclear what would happen. Would we just have to fire people overnight? Would we have to stop doing everything? Or would there be some sort of help?
The Trump administration is wielding the funding cuts as a weapon, turning its adversary's strength, cancer and obesity research, medical breakthroughs, into a weakness, exposing how dependent some schools have become on government dollars. The bulk of that money flows through one place, the National Institutes of Health. Ilya Meretz, reporter and host of the Harvard Plan, takes it from here.
Think about a teacher who made a difference in your life. Did you stay in touch, visit them, maybe send a Christmas card? This story is about a teacher and student who went so much further than that. The student was so inspired by the teacher, he followed in his footsteps, got the exact same academic degrees, then entered the same field. Then they worked together closely. They wrote papers, did research, got grants. For decades, it continued this way. And then something changed. The country changed, and the younger man and the older man found themselves no longer colleagues. They became adversaries in a big, big fight. A fight that is still raging today. At stake are billions of dollars, academic freedom, and the future of science. The older man is the president of Harvard University, Dr. Alan Garber. He's intelligent, kind, mild-mannered, to the point of being a little boring.
The use of data to think about problems. And my dissertation was actually on antibiotic resistance.
The younger man is anything but boring and not at all shy.
Joining me now, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, Stanford University
professor.
Joining
me now is Dr. Jay Bhattacharya.
For the past 5 years, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya has been a fixture on podcasts and Fox News.
Thank you for having me.
And now he's the director of the National Institutes of Health, in charge of a vast pool of public money intended to fund groundbreaking scientific research, and working under the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
It is an honor and a privilege to be able to introduce and recommend to you Dr. Jay Bhattacharya to be President Trump's nominee for the director of the National Institute of Health.
Jay Bhattacharya was introduced in that hearing by a senator. But when I started calling people to report out this story, I learned that he had originally asked someone else to make the introduction, his old mentor, Alan Garber. The president of Harvard was willing to be there to introduce him, to vouch for him. It didn't happen. This episode is about why. It's about the forces that peeled apart two incredibly smart, successful scientists and put them on opposite sides in the fight over universities. Just weeks after Jay Bhattacharya was confirmed, his National Institutes of Health cut off billions of dollars in funding allocated to researchers at Harvard, and dozens of other universities too. We reached out to both men and requested interviews. They both turned us down. In this episode, you'll hear recordings of them from podcasts, TV, and other places, and the voices of the people who know them. Alan and Jay. That's what the people who know them call them. I'm going to call them that too. Let's begin with Jay.
I was born in Calcutta in 1968, well, near Calcutta. And my mom actually grew up in a slum in Calcutta. My dad in a little more middle-class neighborhood.
As he described on the Capitalism and Freedom in the 21st Century podcast, the India where Jayanta Bhattacharya was born was economically poor and also poor in opportunity. When Jayanta was very young, his father won the visa lottery to come to the United States. The family moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and later Southern California. And Jayanta became Jay, an American boy. Every few years, the Bhattacharyas went back to visit aunts and uncles in India. That part was great, having a lot of family. But the poverty made an impression on Jay. He described one trip when he was 8 on Tetragrammaton, music producer Rick Rubin's podcast.
There was this monsoon, but the streets are flooded. There's homeless families, literally, little kids, dogs, moms and dads in the street. And I was like, we're going down some rickshaw to get to the station. And I was like looking around asking my parents, what is this? And that was one of my first impressions of what life was like for poor people in poor countries.
Back in America, young Jay excelled at math and science. When he got to college, his path was clear. He was going to become a doctor. But at Stanford, as he told Rick Rubin, something happened to change his thinking. He took an intro to economics course.
I took it and my brain just lit up. It was like, okay, you can use the math and statistics methods that I thought would be useful for science to ask questions about how people live, how people make decisions when there's scarcity, which is all the time. I knew I still wanted to be a doctor, but I could see how you could use that kind of thinking to make better decisions in medicine.
Could there be a way to do both, though? Economics and medicine. Enter Alan.
I met this man. He was my honors thesis advisor as an undergrad, and he had an MD and a PhD in economics. I absolutely idolized him. His name is Alan Garber.
Idolized him.
Before I met him, I didn't realize it was possible to do the two things together. And after I met him, I'm like, okay, I have to do that.
It takes some imagination to hear what it was about Alan that captivated Jay.
And the trend, which is not statistically significant, actually showed a slight increase in mortality with treatment.
I found this cassette recording of Alan from 1994 speaking to a women's health research seminar.
So there developed a real schism in the medical profession with the majority saying...
Maybe it's this. Cloaked in an Illinois accent and unassuming manner, Alan was fiercely intelligent and ambitious to do things. He was only 13 years older than Jay. 2 advanced degrees, professor at a top college, and, oh, by the way, a practicing physician, too.
He had a great way of setting the patients quickly at ease, often with a smile or a little joke.
This is Dina Bravada, another one of Alan's mentees. When she encountered him in the 1990s, it was at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Palo Alto, where Alan saw patients. Dina Bravada was in training. Many of the men who came in had served in Korea or Vietnam. In addition to common ailments like diabetes or hypertension, they bore the scars of war.
So PTSD, even Agent Orange exposure, these were very, very common issues.
As the internist, Bravada would be the first to meet with a patient. Then she'd bring her notes to Alan, who was the attending physician.
He would often ask one pointed question that would get to the heart of the matter of course, the most important thing for the patient that I had neglected to ask.
What would you say you learned from Alan Garber specifically?
Well, he was my first role model in the trenches, if you will. I hope that I learned from him to be kind, to bring the full measure of one's intellect and training to each patient encounter, and to try to bring one's sense of humor, perhaps, as well.
Alan thrived on being a doctor and a professor. You could do both. But here, Jay's path diverged from Alan's. By the time he completed medical school, Jay found he had lost interest in seeing patients. Again, here he is on the Capitalism and Freedom in the 21st Century podcast.
Every time I would do medicine, I would feel like I was missing doing research. I didn't want to feel like I was only half-heartedly doing it, whereas I was wholeheartedly really interested in research.
And so instead of completing a medical internship and getting licensed like his mentor Alan, Jay goes to work at a think tank, the Rand Corporation in Santa Monica. And he starts mentoring others. Amitav Chandra arrived as a summer intern interested in labor economics. As he recalls, Jay invited him on a walk along the beach and tried to persuade him healthcare economics was the next big thing.
He didn't have to do that for me. He didn't know me at all.
Later, towards the end of the internship, Chandra presented the fruits of his research to the Rand economists. More than anyone else, Jay showed he cared.
I mean, he was completely immersed in the research for an hour and a half. He pushed me in a way that nobody else in that room pushed me. He really wanted to understand where what I was doing broke down. It's not that he didn't believe it. He just wanted to understand, like, okay, you're making this assumption. What if you had made this other assumption instead?
Chandra went on to become a health economist at Harvard. Meeting Jay, he told me, was decisive. Jay didn't stay long at Rand. In 2001, Alan hired him to be a professor at Stanford. The two men were now truly colleagues. This is the period when they do the most research together, often with other academics as well. They tackled the big devils in American healthcare: cancer, aging, the cost of prescription drugs. Again and again, they found ways to work together.
There's a handful of these very special people in the world, and you can count them, like people who will sit down and spend hours and hours with you, helping you be a better scientist without regard for how you are actually going to help them. Right? That makes Alan and Jay extremely special. The other dimension of specialness that's shared by Alan and Jay is they are not ideological about answers. They're extremely data-driven and empirical about answers. And you can get both of them to change their mind, which is another, the third dimension of them being special. Because there are some people who care about evidence, who will mentor other people, but they're not going to change their mind.
In 2011, Alan was recruited to become provost at Harvard, chief academic officer, really, the number two there. He left California, but he kept Jay in his life. Alan had just obtained an NIH grant to study rising Medicare costs. He brought on Jay as a collaborator. The project lasted 5 years and took in several million dollars, ending only in 2016. I very much doubt either Alan or Jay had any inkling Jay would one day lead the NIH and what that would mean for Alan. People who knew Jay then say he was a consummate professor, committed to classroom debate and scholarly discussion in the pages of academic journals. He was not looking to get famous or climb any ladder. Then, the pandemic came, and everything changed. This is episode 2 of The Harvard Plan. More after the break. Stay with us.
On the Media is supported by BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
and by Progressive Insurance, presenting Progressive's Name Your Price tool, which shows customers coverage options that fit their needs. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and On the Media. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, weekend edition from National Public Radio. We'll also hear the Up North Report, local news from our region. And you can find more local stories at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Our weather for today, partly sunny, highs in the low 30s, winds from the north 5 to 15. Lows tonight in the mid to upper teens, and for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs again in the low 30s. Blustery northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. There is a grand opening today for the new Minnesota Ski Jumping Museum. That is from noon to 4 at Mount Itasca near Coleraine. See historic artifacts and learn about local champions.
This is On the Media. I'm Ilya Meritz, host of The Harvard Plan, a collaboration between OTM and the Boston Globe. To recap, we've met our two protagonists, the doctor economists Alan Garber and Jay Bhattacharya, two men whose careers seemed destined to follow a similar trajectory until the arrival of a deadly, fast-spreading illness that came to be known as COVID.
Here with me, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. Dr. B, I think you were probably on the show, I don't even know how many times, like 40 times during COVID, 50 times.
In March of 2020, President Trump declared a national emergency due to the pandemic. From the start, Jay saw things differently from much of the public health establishment, which urged lockdowns and moving life online. To Jay, there was so much we still did not know about the disease, like how many people had contracted it without even knowing it. Just after lockdowns went into effect, Jay co-wrote an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal, arguing that there wasn't enough evidence for the virus's lethality to justify stay-at-home orders. Then he and some colleagues pulled together an analysis of data from Santa Clara County, where Stanford is located. They concluded a lot more people had already had COVID than was known, meaning the disease really was less dangerous than the authorities were saying. In October 2020, after a little over 6 months of lockdowns, Jay and two other scholars came together to issue a manifesto. They did this at the headquarters of a libertarian think tank in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The Great Barrington Declaration called for something radically different, which they called focused protection. For most people, there should be a return to in-person living. Herd immunity would provide enough protection, while the elderly and vulnerable could quarantine and get vaccines once they became available.
This is the saner approach, the more moral approach, the more scientifically based approach.
Within days, Jay and the other two authors were invited to meet with two Trump appointees, including the then Secretary of Health and Human Services. Trump World had begun to embrace the Great Barrington Declaration. But the public health establishment was appalled. Dr. Ashish Jha used to work under Allen at Harvard School of Public Health and went on to advise the Biden administration on COVID policy. He's now the dean of the School of Public Health at Brown.
I had very strong disagreements with that piece. I thought it was really ill-timed that it came out a month before vaccines were available. I mean, the idea that, like, you're going to kind of lift all restrictions, just let everybody get infected a month before vaccines come out just doesn't make any sense.
But lately, there's been a recognition by Jha and others that the declaration probably got some things right, too.
He was pushing for schools to open in a way that a lot of people weren't, and I thought that was smart and good.
Still, for Jay, his outspokenness came with professional consequences. Within Stanford, where he still taught, Jay was blocked from giving a talk about the declaration, he says. And then, as he told Rick Rubin, he was investigated by the school.
It felt like an inquisition. They're asking me about 1,000 questions about, like, my motivations.
He kept his job. Stanford never answered our questions about that. Jay's feeling of being picked on, disrespected, was amped up when emails surfaced in a Freedom of Information request showing the then director of the NIH, Francis Collins, referred to Jay and his Great Barrington allies in an email to his colleague Anthony Fauci as fringe epidemiologists, and urged a quick and devastating published takedown. As Jay told Laura Ingram,
It feels like some novel from the 1950s where the House Un-American Committee is like meeting to decide who to suppress. And I'm some sort of like movie star in Hollywood that they're blacklisting because I'm a communist or something. It's ridiculous. If we had an open discussion, the lockdowns would have been lifted much earlier because the data and evidence behind them was so bad.
Like so much else in American life, COVID had become a polarizing issue, a wedge. No doubt Jay's critics thought they were acting in the urgent interest of public health. Jay saw them as comfortable elites with no awareness of their own blind spots, as he described it on Andrew Huberman's podcast.
The lockdowns were a luxury of the laptop class.
So Jay made allies where he found them, even if his new crowd had a weakness for pseudoscience and quackery.
Amazingly, there appear to be growing connections between Viagra and treatment for the coronavirus.
Ivermectin, as well as other proactive
taking hydroxy as a way to prevent from getting the virus.
I have asked myself, why did I have this very different reaction to the lockdown?
Jay, again, on Rick Rubin's podcast.
Because one of my very first thoughts when I heard about the lockdown was that experience when I was 8. Seeing what life is like for poor people. I just had this like vision of like, this is gonna happen at scale to every poor person on earth.
Jay thought of the India he saw in the 1970s with power cuts and a fragile economy.
We're essentially pulling the rug out from under the sort of the economic infrastructure that allows poor people to have some semblance of access to food, access to healthcare, all this stuff. And we just basically said, no, the fear around this virus, the well-being of like relatively well-off people is so much more important than that.
While Jay became a public opinion haver with a following, Allen went in the opposite direction. As provost at Harvard, he built consensus, ran meetings, spoke publicly only on occasion. When the pandemic came, Allen led the university's COVID advisory group. Learning quickly moved online, dorms emptied out, many classrooms didn't reopen for over a year. I'm not so sure Allen personally favored this approach, though. Early in the pandemic, Allen had co-authored an opinion piece in the New York Times warning against taking measures that would shut down the economy. The piece even mentions herd immunity as the pathway back to normal life, not so different from the Great Barrington Declaration. But the policies Harvard adopted were in line with what public health authorities recommended. A couple years later, as Harvard entered its worst leadership crisis in years with its first black president under withering attack, Allen remained as provost, embodying continuity.
My name is Claudine Gay, and I'm the president of Harvard University. It's an honor to be here today.
And when that new president was hauled before Congress and questioned by Republican Elise Stefanik, Allen sat directly behind her.
Let me ask you this. You are president of Harvard, so I assume you're familiar with the term intifada, correct?
For over 5 hours, he occasionally nodded at something or other she said, but betrayed very little emotion.
A call for violent armed resistance against the state of Israel, including violence against civilians and the genocide of Jews. Are you aware of that?
That type of hateful speech is personally abhorrent.
The hearing was ostensibly about the campus reaction to Hamas's attack on Israel, but there were all kinds of pent-up complaints about how college had changed. It was ideologically rigid, lacking conservatives, lacking the capacity for debate. Diversity, equity, and inclusion programs were a waste of time. Within a month of the hearing, Gay was out of the job, and Allen became Harvard's acting leader. At the end of 2024, he was sworn in as Harvard's official, actual president. This is the moment, for many people, when Allen first came into focus. He grew up in a small Midwestern city. His father had a liquor store. He was raised Jewish and is observant. He graduated from Harvard College, class of 1976. In true all roads lead back to Harvard fashion, Allen's year also included Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and John Roberts, now Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
So I got to know Allen when, actually just before he came to Harvard, he was still at Stanford.
Dan Lieberman is a professor of evolutionary biology and Allen's longtime running buddy. Allen had read some of Lieberman's academic work and got in touch.
And he had had some running injuries, and I've published a lot on the biomechanics of running. So we had lunch somewhere in the square and talked about running. And then I invited him to come to my lab so we could study his gait. I have a fancy treadmill and all this fancy equipment.
And you said study his gait, how he runs.
Yes, his running gait, and because he had some injuries. So after we had this lunch, he came to my lab, and I found out that he was hitting the ground really hard.
Once you start thinking about Alan running long distances, concentrating on modifying his stride, the parallels to his current predicament are almost too tempting. Lieberman told me that on one of their runs years ago, Alan suggested he pick up a book about Stoicism by William Irvine, and he did. Lieberman sees Alan's low-drama, analytical approach as the key to how he handles most challenges, including the government's pressure campaign right now.
He's not very emotional about the crisis, which is a really very serious crisis. He's just very much focused on the facts, like what's going on and what to do.
A lot of people who know Alan talk about him this way. But surely rationality will only get you so far in a world where the old rule book has been tossed out. I prodded Lieberman to help me think this thing through. How does someone like Alan, who has lived his whole adult life in the halls of the academy, deal with an aggressive antagonist who has no respect for rules or established precedent? Knife to a gunfight. You know what I mean.
I mean, a lot of norms have been broken. I think the most basic norm that's been broken is essentially the golden rule, to treat others as you would have them treat you. And right now we're in a world where people are quite happy to ignore that in all kinds of levels. And I would say that this particular fight is just one of them.
The winds were changing direction fast at the moment Alan became Harvard president. A lot of the stuff that had been built at Harvard when he was provost was now being undone. The Faculty of Arts and Sciences dropped diversity statements. The DEI office was renamed. Harvard adopted an institutional voice policy. Other places call it institutional neutrality, to put an end to the expectation that Harvard speak about the pressing social issues of the day. There were revised policies on student protest and discipline. Plenty of people at Harvard were unhappy with these changes. Because he is so precise, so guarded, so cautious, because he works by consensus, it's hard to say whether the new order more closely reflects Alan's actual view of how universities should be. But all of this was poor insurance against what was coming. That's after the break. This is episode 2 of The Harvard Plan.
On the Media is supported by Swan Auction Galleries, an auction house of collectors for collectors since 1941, offering live in-person auctions in New York City and online live bidding from afar. Swan Auction schedule is available at swangalleries.com. And by Seed.com. Seed's DS01 is a 24-strain, 2-in-1 probiotic and prebiotic engineered to survive digestion, support healthy regularity, and promote whole-body health. Learn more at seed.com/public.
This is On the Media. I'm Ilya Meritz, host of The Harvard Plan, a collaboration from OTM and the Boston Globe. As the 2024 presidential race took shape, Harvard was changing, but slower than the speed of politics. The Republican nominee, Donald Trump, campaigned for president on the most anti-higher ed platform in recent memory.
The time has come to reclaim our once great educational institutions from the radical left, and we will do that.
And he won. And then he started building his team, selecting people for the top jobs in government. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a noted adherent of conspiracy theories about vaccines, would lead the Department of Health and Human Services.
The Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions will please come to order.
To lead the National Institutes of Health, which is part of HHS, Trump chose someone with a lot more scientific cred.
Thank you, Dr. Bhattacharya, for appearing before the committee.
Context. It was March of 2025, 6 weeks into the new administration. And a new non-agency agency, the Department of Government Efficiency, staffed by Elon Musk's trusted people, had been moving through the organs of the U.S. government one by one, slashing staff and programs.
I don't have my gavel, but Senator Murray said it's a DOGE cut. So anyway.
Now DOGE had come for the NIH's $48 billion annual budget and its workforce of 20,000. Clinical trials were paused, grants frozen, firings en masse. And senators were on edge. And so it was under that cloud that Jay introduced himself.
I'm honored to speak with you today and deeply humbled by President Trump's nomination.
I'm delighted to have with me my wife, Kathy, my son, Matthew, and my brother.
Remember how I told you earlier that Alan had agreed to introduce Jay at his confirmation hearing? How Jay wanted him to be there? This is that moment. But Alan was not in the room.
The NIH has played a pivotal role in my career. I served for a decade as a standing member of NIH grant committees.
To the senators who thought the NIH was functioning great up until Elon Musk came along, Jay delivered a bucket of ice-cold water.
American health is going backwards.
Life expectancy has flatlined, he said, and there have been a bunch of research scandals. Public faith in science reflects this, he said.
A November 2024 Pew study reported that only 26% of the American public had a great deal of confidence in scientists to act in the public's best interest. 23% have not much or no confidence at all.
Bill Cassidy, a Republican and the committee chairman, is a doctor, a liver disease specialist who co-founded a clinic for the uninsured.
Thank you, sir. I'll start with questionings.
He went straight for the tension at the heart of this job.
There's now a child who died from a vaccine-preventable disease in Texas. Let me repeat that. A child who died from a vaccine-preventable disease in Texas.
Measles, a disease for which there is a safe vaccine, was raging just then. For years, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, had been telling parents vaccines may cause autism. Kennedy would be Jay's boss.
Senator, it's a tragedy that a child would die from a vaccine-preventable disease. I fully support.
Jay affirmed his support for vaccinating kids for measles, but noted there's been a sharp rise in autism cases, and he said, we don't know the reasons why.
So I would support an agenda of a broad scientific agenda based on data to get an answer to that.
Cassidy seemed genuinely disturbed that Jay was not swatting down the baseless linkage. He came back to this point again and again.
My concern is the more we pretend like this is an issue, the more we will have children dying from vaccine-preventable diseases.
Senator, I guess I've turned it around and say I don't want to disprove a negative. That's impossible, really.
Jay suggested if part of the public has doubts about science, refuses to believe in it, then science must do better. Try harder to convince them. Jay seemed to have intuited something essential about the job he was trying out for. More than impress the senators, he needed to show his prospective bosses, Trump and Kennedy, that he will respect the conspiracy theory and viral disinformation crowd.
I mean, I guess, yes, you're absolutely right, Senator. We don't need to address every idea that or concern. But if those concerns result in parents not wanting to vaccinate their children for a vaccine that is well-tested, my sense is that my inclination is to give people good data. That's how you address those concerns.
We don't know why Alan didn't introduce Jay at that hearing, but we can imagine what he might have said about his former student. He might have talked about Jay's curiosity, his refusal to accept conventional wisdom at face value, his passion for science. He might have spoken about the decades they worked together as colleagues on containing Medicare costs, aging, fighting cancer. And he might have noted Trump's pressure campaign on universities, which was then gaining force, and called for a truce. Jay was confirmed in a party line vote. Senator Cassidy, his biggest Republican skeptic, supported him in the end. At the start of April, Jay was installed as NIH director, with RFK Jr. administering the oath.
Welcome aboard. The revolution begins today.
At Donald Trump's NIH, now Jay Bhattacharya's NIH too, things were changing fast.
The Trump administration has now frozen more than $2 billion in federal research funding.
This would impact medical, engineering, and science research at the school.
That is looking for cures for some of our most devastating diseases.
I've lost grants that have totaled $6 or $7 million.
In early May, the NIH sent a letter to Alan, a letter which I think is significant, even though really it's a formality. It's from a senior NIH staffer informing Alan that Harvard's grant money has been terminated because Harvard's conduct around anti-Semitism is so bad in the eyes of the government. Still, the penultimate paragraph offers Alan one thin reed of hope. He could appeal the decision directly to Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, director of the NIH.
I wonder what Alan thinks.
when he gets that letter.
Again, Dr. Ashish Jha. He knows both Alan and Jay. I described the contents of the letter to him.
I don't know for sure, but I know how Alan's going to behave. Alan's going to send it to his lawyers, and they're going to write up the letter, and he'll be very formal. But Alan's also a human being. There's got to be part of him that's got to be struggling with this.
True to form, Alan responded calmly, rationally, when he was asked about the cuts on NPR.
Do you really want to cut back on research dollars? There is a lot of actual research demonstrating the returns to the American people have been enormous.
So that's Alan.
And Jay is a fundamentally good guy. And he has got to be, when he's lying in bed, going to sleep, he's got to be thinking about, like, how much longer do I tolerate being in a place where I'm going after my friends and who are great researchers and great institutions?
One reason I wanted to talk with Ashish Jha is that, like Jay, he's a scientist who went to Washington. He became President Biden's COVID response advisor.
What happens when doctors and health economists go to Washington, particularly people who haven't been involved in politics?
Yeah. It's a steep learning curve, and you got to get learning real, real fast. I spent a lot of time trying to think about where are my lanes of influence? How do I move policy? What do I care about? What are battles that I'm willing to have? What are battles I'm willing to lose? I picked battles that I thought were really, really important. And then I use all of my connections, my relationships to figure out how to get the things that I wanted to get accomplished. It's hard. It's a steep learning curve.
In his confirmation hearing, Jay laid out his goals for the National Institutes of Health. He wants to fund more early career scientists, more moonshot research. He says for too long, the agency has been too careful, favoring incremental projects instead of big leaps. Jay actually co-wrote a whole paper about this back in 2020. So those are his priorities. They may or may not be his boss's priorities.
His direct boss, RFK Jr., doesn't believe in germ theory, doesn't believe in vaccines.
Yeah.
Believes a lot of stuff that probably Jay, from his own experience and training as an academic, disagrees with.
Yeah.
But there are points of agreement,
sure,
about free speech and making space for other kinds of viewpoints, and there are places where they agree on sort of like make America healthy. Is there any way for Jay to sort of split the difference and preserve his dignity and preserve the respect of people in the scientific community?
Yes. There always is. There always is. You have to, again, decide which stuff is most important. You're not going to win every battle. RFK Jr. has decided that the big issue of American diet is food dyes. No serious person thinks that. But if Jay has to go out and talk about food dyes every once in a while, I think it's fine. Like, no, we're all going to kind of be like, we get what he's doing. But he gets to do that if he's preserving the core stuff. If he is overseeing the destruction of the core things and talking about food dyes, then he doesn't get to retain his credibility and his standing.
We did this interview in July, by the way. Over the summer and into the fall, Jay's leadership at NIH seemed to unfold as a series of agility tests. He submitted and defended in Congress a budget request that's almost 40% smaller. He defended the decision to cancel mRNA vaccine development, which scientists consider to be extremely promising. Meanwhile, President Trump moved to give political appointees, not committees of area expert scientists, authority over research funding, giving him, Trump, effectively more power over how the money is spent. One of Jay's colleagues, the head of the Centers for Disease Control, was forced out of the job after less than a month. She said RFK Jr. politicized our processes and repeatedly censored science. In September, Trump gave a news conference where he said painkillers could cause autism, which is not true, according to major medical and scientific groups.
With Tylenol, don't take it. Don't take it.
Look to Trump's right side. Jay is there beside his boss, RFK Jr. They're there for over an hour. When it's his turn to speak, Jay does not endorse or refute the purported link between Tylenol and autism, but announces a new program to pump $50 million additional dollars into peer-reviewed autism research.
For too long, it's been taboo to ask some questions for fear the scientific work might reveal a politically incorrect answer.
Jay's colleagues in health economics are near unanimous that he believes in good science, but within the NIH, a lot of people are worried. In June, a group of NIH staffers put out their own manifesto, the Bethesda Declaration. They contend that the Trump administration and NIH harmed academic freedom by selectively canceling high-quality work at out-of-favor universities. They say that essential research into health disparities has been blocked, even when it does not include the words diversity, equity, and inclusion. The declaration has close to 500 signatures just from current employees.
So we described it as dissent.
Sarah Coburn is one of them, a 21-year NIH veteran who agreed to speak with me in her personal capacity.
You know, he laid that out for us. He has his own letter of dissent. He says publicly very often that he welcomes dissent. And so he said specifically in our letter and even in the email that accompanied the letter, we hope you welcome this dissent.
Jay did not at first respond directly, but posted his thoughts on X, saying the declaration contained misconceptions about NIH's new policy direction. But then, in July, he invited many of the signers to meet with him. Sarah Coburn told me Jay was courteous, personable. He listened.
One of the things that he told us several times and wanted to emphasize, it seemed, was that there are no bad words that cause grants to be cut or not funded. There are no bad words. And those of us who were spending a lot of time most days evaluating grants for their use of bad words know that that's not the case.
Coburn and others saw grants connected with ideas like gender and diversity being blocked, although exactly how this was happening was not totally clear to them.
In our thank you note, we did say thank you and then said one urgent note. You said that there are no bad words, and we don't think that message is making it all the way down to the people who are making the funding choices. If you could please communicate that more strongly, we would be appreciative, or something along those lines. I don't think he's the one choosing what gets cut. I don't think he's the one. Yeah, that's the reason. I think those priorities are not his personally, not his scientifically. They come from elsewhere.
Although the meeting was cordial, it didn't leave Coburn feeling optimistic.
He wants to be a scientific colleague working in collaboration at NIH for the good of NIH. But that's not really the truth of the job he's accepted.
We sent the NIH a detailed list of questions raised by our reporting. A spokesperson responded with some bullet points. She did not address the idea of banned words, but told us any updates to NIH review processes aim to strengthen accountability and efficiency while maintaining the central role of expert peer review. As for Jay's relationship with Allen, the spokesperson called it a personal matter. The disgruntled NIH staffers' manifesto, the Bethesda Declaration in 2025, followed Jay's Great Barrington Declaration in 2020. Both documents, in response to a sense that scientific inquiry and speech were being improperly stifled. The idea of speech, the proper boundaries of it, who sets the rules, it runs through this whole thing. For example, on September 3rd, Jay gave a talk at the National Conservatism Conference. He had top billing alongside Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and OMB Director Russell Vogt. Jay recounted what happened to him on Twitter a few years back.
I was very naive. I just thought I was going to join Twitter to tell people about the Great Barrington Declaration. When Elon Musk bought Twitter a couple of years later, it turned out that the day I joined Twitter in August of 2021, I had been placed on a blacklist. I found this out because Elon Musk invited me to Twitter headquarters, and I got to see with my own eyes the database with my face on it and the word blacklist written over it.
Jay said his speech was suppressed at the request of the Biden administration, although, as he acknowledged, he was not directly personally singled out by the White House. Still, the Biden people did ask social media companies to help contain the spread of what they considered harmful messaging around COVID. Jay joined a lawsuit over this, which went all the way to the Supreme Court. His co-plaintiffs included the states of Missouri and Louisiana, and the Gateway Pundit, a hub for conspiracy theories. And Jay's side lost in a 6-3 decision. He says that shows the First Amendment is on thin ice.
At this point, the only thing protecting free speech in this country is, frankly, is President Trump.
Jay did not mention that his own parent agency, HHS, had been sued by Harvard for violating its free speech rights when research dollars were cut. In court, Harvard argued that the government pressure campaign, the weaponized research dollars, amounted to attempted interference in what can be taught and who can be hired. This is something Allen talks about.
We cannot compromise on basic principles like defense of our First Amendment rights.
The very same day Jay went on stage to claim his speech had been improperly suppressed, the judge in Harvard's lawsuit against the government issued her decision. She granted Harvard summary judgment on most of its claims. What lies at the core of this dispute, she wrote, is the fact that defendants are trying to pressure Harvard to accede to the government's demands in a way that squarely violates plaintiffs' First Amendment rights. She went on, in language that is bracingly direct, "The idea that fighting anti-Semitism is defendants' true aim is belied by the fact that the majority of the demands they are making of Harvard to restore its research funding are directed on their face at Harvard's governance, staffing, and hiring practices and admissions policies, all of which have little to do with anti-Semitism and everything to do with defendants' power and political views."
Okay, we are now recording. Hey, Sarah, how are you doing?
Hi, doing okay.
Do you want to give me the business again?
I caught up with Sarah Cobrin in late September, about 2 months after our first conversation.
Yes, so just to be clear, I'm speaking as myself. I'm a person, citizen of the United States.
Not in her role as an NIH staffer. Now that that was clear, I wanted to know how things were going for her and the other signers of the Bethesda Declaration.
So this was actually my number one question, whether there have been any reprisals of any kind.
No.
Okay.
Not at NIH, just no.
So that's the good news. The bad news, everyone is stressed, everything feels broken.
It's 8 months now of being asked to do things that we think are wrong.
The formerly functional grant review process has lately been turned on its head, she told me. High-quality proposals are not getting approved. Is it because of something they wrote?
Now the new administration is saying, okay, we have some new criteria we want to use, but we won't tell you what they are. Grants being caught up in spreadsheets, and the program directors being told, these grants were flagged. They were flagged. And we don't want to tell you what search terms we used, and we don't want to tell you what it is that we want to cut. We just want you to figure it out. And Dr. Bhattacharya, when we met with him at that roundtable, said, no, there are no banned words. He said that to our faces. And we said to him, that's great. Please communicate that to the IC directors and the grants management people because they're hearing something else.
IC directors, those are the directors of institutes and centers. The NIH contains 27 of these, like the National Cancer Institute, where Cobrin works. They're supposed to be reviewing grants, funding science, but with no formal list of banned words, it's all guesswork.
So we are between a rock and a rock and a rock. A judge has said it's illegal to do it. Our leadership is telling us we have to do it. Our boss is telling us it doesn't exist.
Jay said science should not be partisan. Cobrin told me any scientist applying today for federal money would have to have an acute sense of the Trump administration's politics rather than relying on traditional scoring by a committee of scientists.
So people won't be able to have a sense, oh, I got an excellent score. No, the score is only going to be one piece. That's the peer review result. And that the ultimate decisions will be made by the presidential appointees who are now numerous within NIH and many more numerous than in the past. We used to only have two. Now we have dozens.
I thought about Camilla Naxarova, the Harvard cancer researcher we met in the last episode. She told us back in July that she is prepared for her current NIH grants, which were recently restored by court order but could be challenged again. She is prepared for these grants to potentially disappear and never come back.
I think I could live with that. I would just work really hard and write new ones, somehow make it work.
But then you think about what else could happen.
Maybe a budget cut. Okay, so that would be bad. Then this means you would have to write even more grants and do an even better job. Maybe you could still get funded. I could live with that too. But then it sounds like they're trying to make further changes to the system where not only are the grants reviewed now, but then there is some political appointee that looks at them and that can decide, you know, based on, I don't know what criteria, you know, whether they're in the national interest or not.
Science moves at its own speed, ignorant of the rhythms of politics.
We can only do the work if we can do it for a long time. Otherwise, there's no point in even doing it. So if that becomes more of a concern that your grants may get yanked as political situations shift, then I think I'd want to leave. I think I wouldn't do it anymore just because it's not just not possible. I can't work on projects with a one-year outlook. I would go look for a different job.
Allen told the Wall Street Journal, it's not just about Harvard or universities. It's about America's place in the world.
For example, quantum science, which right now is a huge strategic area for the nation, particularly in our competition with China. They support this research because of the economic benefits.
Ashish Jha is more direct.
The heart of the biomedical and the convergence of biology and IT and AI in America is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And that's where they have taken their gun.
He is very concerned that China is pulling ahead of the U.S. in biosciences. He says we were neck and neck recently.
Now we're behind. And
already?
Yeah. Like every serious person understands, we are now behind China.
Time is running out for the United States to hold its own against a rising China. Time is also running out for colleges and universities to settle on a strategy to defend themselves. Time is running out for Allen Garber to preserve everything Harvard is and has built. And time is running out for Jay Bhattacharya to leave the kind of mark he wants to make on American science.
This is the most self-destructive move I've seen an administration do. And Jay is at the heart of that self-destructive behavior. Jay must know this. He must understand this. If he has credibility, which I believe he does, and if he has integrity, which I believe he does, he has got to wrap this battle up quickly and move forward with getting America back on track. Because otherwise, generations of people will look back and not blame just Donald Trump and RFK Jr., but Jay Bhattacharya on overseeing the great American loss to China.
Coming up on the final episode of the Harvard Plan Season 2, what if there were a way to ensure that critical research does get funded? The Trump administration is proposing a science grants fast lane for universities that sign on to its vision for higher ed.
The compact list things that I think are pretty, I don't actually find them controversial.
We meet the Trump advisor behind what they're calling the compact.
Merit-based admissions, merit-based hiring, grade inflation. These are the types of things that I don't feel like are partisan. They are actually just defining the necessary elements to a strong relationship.
That's next week. The Harvard Plan, Season 2, is reported and written by me, Ilya Marantz. The series is produced by On the Media's Molly Rosen. It's edited by Kristen Nelson, head of audio for the Boston Globe, and Katya Rogers, On the Media's executive producer. Mixing and original music by Jared Paul. Tom Colligan is the fact checker. Thanks to the Boston Globe's editor, Nancy Barnes, and to Ryan Huddle for episode art. And thanks to Jasmine Aguilera and Valentina Powers. I'll see you next week for episode 3 of The Harvard Plan. This is On the Media.
It's a minute before 7 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 in the Brainerd area, also on your smart speaker, or people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, weekend edition from National Public Radio. And at 9 o'clock this morning, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, get out your dancing shoes. We'll hear stories about learning to dance, the polka capital of the world, and more. That's this morning at 9. You can also catch it Sunday at 5. Stage North Theater presents 10 November, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, now through Monday at the Franklin Arts Center in Brainerd. Find showtimes and tickets at stagenorththeater.com. Thanks for tuning in to KAXE this morning. Time now for Weekend Edition.